Today's guest is Sheila Wysocki. Sheila Wysocki became a private investigator late in life to investigate the murder of her roommate, Angela Sumata. And she's continued on being an investigator who helps victims who've given up hope with cold cases. I'm so excited to have her on. She is an amazing individual.
Structured.
Thanks for coming on, Sheila. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you for asking me. I appreciate it.
I'm really, really honored to have you. And I love your story. I love the fact that you were living one life and later on in life, you just said, okay, I want to do something else. And that is a remarkable thing. Now, you became a PI in 2013. Is that correct?
2004. I became a PI in 2004. 2013 is when I became a PI for other reasons. 2004, I became a PI to solve my roommate's murder. 2010, I was going to retire my license because the guy that murdered my roommate was convicted and is on death row.
Now that's fascinating. Yeah. Okay. So you became a PI just to get access.
Yes. Well, not in respect, I thought if I became a PI, this is how stupid I was. I thought if I became a PI, that the police would open arms and embrace me, which didn't happen.
Yeah, and I definitely want to cover that. I just think that's an interesting angle that you want information. And you found a way. So they didn't open their arms and embrace you. You could force them.
No.
So that was good.
Yes. Yeah. I got what I wanted.
One way or another.
Right.
I'm surprised too that I guess you probably would have wound up being either a PI or an investigative journalist.
I think you're both when you're a PI.
Are you? Okay.
Makes sense. A podcaster.
Now. Absolutely. Yeah. A very successful show too.
It's doing well, and I appreciate the listeners.
And let's spin into that, because one of the questions I had for you is, you are investigating cases, and these are potentially murder trials. Last time I checked, that ain't cheap.
No.
So how are these families funding this? How are you being funded? You're not a charity, are you?
Well... You have to ask my husband and my boys. So a couple of things on how is it being funded. When someone hires me, this is what I tell them now, because I know the routine and I know the process. They have to have $100,000. That's not my fee. That's the process fee of getting experts and getting their case truly investigated. So if you don't have $100,000, and if you're going to court, you better have $500,000. So my cases, unfortunately, can take up to, I'm on two cases at 5 years, but I don't give up on the cases. So I do pro bono work, not a lot, because I don't have as much time as I used to. So yes, I do have a 501c3, and investigators help me investigate. The podcast I've done on my own. And that was surprising how expensive it was. So I had editors I brought in really good editors and we just did our taxes. We're at $100,000 on it. I know. Pass out. My husband is about to, he's an accountant, a CPA.
Bad combo.
He is having, so I had to go ahead and start getting sponsors to help out.
Good. Is that helping cut into that?
I have yet to get a check, but I have sponsors now.
That's a start. The problem is, and I could tell you from running a podcast myself, I'm treating it as if it's a restaurant that I opened. Typically, it takes 2 years of losing money before you ever think about turning a profit or even breaking even in a restaurant.
Good to know. And of course, Eric, you and I have a podcast going, you know how hard it is. I have 5 years of audio that I'm pulling and working on, and no one knows it as well as I do. So in order to cut costs, I've started doing the editing, and I've started doing everything but the mixing and mastering. And that's cut the cost and brought in sponsors. And I have really good national sponsors that have approached me. And that's good. But it's uber expensive. I don't have the families fund it because I don't want two things. I don't want to be dictated what I should and should not say.
Sure.
And they've already put, like, the Lauren Agee case, she's already in $300,000 for her case just to find answers. Hello.
I believe it. I had a lawyer on, Richie Lamuro. He's a trial lawyer out of New Jersey. He's at the state bar and can argue in front of the state Supreme Court now. And he talked about what people don't see, which is, as the defense, you have to come up with everything. You have to pay for your own experts, your own forensic technicians, you know, all these people, whereas the state has a bottomless pool. So they literally have an army, potentially, that you may be going against.
Right. In my cases, Eric, the reason they cost so much is I insist that we have everything. So I bring in, if you are handed a case from me, you have had the best experts, like a hydrologist, who even knew what that was before.
Right.
And you've had the best person to look at the case, because I don't want to tell the parents, this is what happened and it wasn't what happened. I want to scientifically prove what happened.
Now, this comes out of personal experience, correct? Because you suspected somebody in your roommate's murder for the majority of your life, or, you know, a big chunk of it, and you were wrong, which nothing is you. I mean, we are often wrong, and everything lined up against him.
The interesting thing is, when I initially was told about, his name's Russell, and he and I are great friends. I talk about him a lot, but that is the reason. Because the police, when I was 20, so of course I believed everything I was told by a homicide detective. And he said, this is our guy. And then he laid out a case, 20 years old, police know everything. Of course, that's back in the 80s where you didn't question authority at all.
Sure.
And so I was told.
Especially in Texas. You were in Texas.
Absolutely.
So even more there. I mean, they questioned a little bit in New York.
Good observation. You're right. But, you know, here I am. I'm devastated. I've got, I've seen pictures I never thought I would see in my entire life with someone I cared about. And I'm being told the guy who did it, and this is the reason why and how he did it, all made sense to me. So for, you're exactly right, for until 2004, that's who I thought, actually until 2009, I thought he did it. Then he didn't. So now in my cases, we don't have that. We go in and we get the scientific proof. And I can sit down and scientifically say to the families, this is what I believe.
And I can't help but say, but thank God for DNA. Without that, you'd still suspect them, very possibly.
You know what? Thank God for DNA. And yes, that whole thing changed. Thank God for all the scientific trace evidence advancements.
Now, that makes me wonder, and I want to go down this path because we were discussing beforehand about police, and I'm going to say cognitive bias, I think, is a huge problem. Why is it, I keep reading over and over and over about a death row inmate or another inmate, somebody who's just saying, all I want is for you to run DNA. Please just run DNA on the crime scene. And prosecutors and police are some of them just, they fight it tooth and nail and will not do this. Do you have any speculation as to why?
I think that is a question that's ongoing everywhere. I ask that same question. Why? Why not go and find the truth? What difference does it make? So you have the human factor, and this is purely my opinion, But there are cases where the police just don't like you. They want to put you away, clear their case, easy. Just Is Mercy, that movie coming out in February with Michael B. Jordan. I was on the set of that watching the trial scene. And that's the Bryan Stevens movie, Bryan Stevenson's movie. And he gets people off death row. I don't work death row cases because there are so many people out there working them.
Right.
The Innocence Project. I have so much respect for those people. I work with victims' families. But on death row, you've got people that were put there because the local police don't care for them or the prosecutor hid some evidence. And it is a systemic problem. Now,
is that what it is? Let me speculate. You just popped something in my head. Is it a case of, okay, well, maybe he didn't do that, but he did 10 other things.
That is it. And when that movie comes out, that Just Mercy movie comes out, I would love for you to watch it and tell me what you think.
Yeah, especially if you're a technical consultant on it. That's pretty cool.
I'm not a technical consultant. They invited me up because I work the opposite end. I work for victims' families.
I see.
And I wanted to see how they were presenting this movie, if they were accurate or not. They had Brie Larson's and Brie Larson, Jamie Foxx, and Michael B. Jordan. It's going to be a very good movie. And what's interesting about it, they were so true to the facts, and I didn't know if they would or would not be.
Oh, good.
They were.
Okay, that's good. Good to hear. On that, you yourself have had trouble with law enforcement, it seems, in multiple locations. And probably, I'd say the crowning example is the Holly Bobo case. Would that be fair?
That is fair. So, yes, I am asked a lot, who am I scared of when I work cases? And my answer, unfortunately, is generally law enforcement. Because I'm set up to go in and criticize them. And first of all, I am a female. I'm older female. And I go in saying, in a nice Southern way, hey, guys, you got it wrong. Doesn't matter. And I think, you know, I joke about it because you have to, because it is completely scary. Plus, I go after judges. Not, I don't go after. I criticize judges. I criticize everybody in authority. And so in a DA, oh my gosh, I criticize DAs. So they don't care for me. Now, I do have some that work with me. Interesting enough, recently the ones that have worked with me lost their jobs.
And you've had a reporter lose his or her job too. Is that Dennis Ferrier?
Dennis Ferrier. So let me tell you about that.
Let's go through the whole story. Yeah, I definitely want to.
Okay. So it's a horrible story because this is when I was naive, where I thought, hey, we're rowing to the same finish line. We all want to find out what happened to this young lady. Mm-hmm. I had suspects. I had worked with the family, developed an idea of what happened. And the reporter and I decided, hey, let's get some press on it. We'll do kind of a documentary style 5-day, you know, one after another, talking about it. So one of the things I do in all my cases is a reenactment of what's been told. So you are a witness and you've given a statement. We reenact it. So what the reporter and I did is we reenacted everything. Okay. To the point, this is how detailed I am. To the point, the brother in that case said he saw the guy in camo. We had the camo that he said he saw on the person reenacting the case.
Let's back up a little bit just so people understand it. In the Holly Bobo case, we had a young woman who was kidnapped or abducted from her property while her brother was at home. And the brother potentially witnessed it?
Yes.
Okay. And can we continue on that? I just wanted to lay
that out. Absolutely. So the reporter and I did a lot of filming with the cooperation of the family. And understand, in all my cases, I have full cooperation of the family.
Okay.
So we do this, and unfortunately, it does not show well to the state police, TBI. And I started hearing from some of my friends.
And that's Tennessee Bureau of Investigation?
Correct. At that time, Mark Gwynn was the head of TBI. And one of the statements that was repeated to me was, Mark Gwynn was so mad at me. He has never been madder in his entire life than when we did this. And my response was, I would think when a 20-year-old girl was abducted from the back of her home, that's when you're the maddest, not when someone is out there saying, let's solve it.
Now, some of this was a conflict between the original investigator and you, or is it later investigators? Because I think Terry Dykus was the original investigator. Is that correct?
No, the conflict was I showed him up on TV, period. That they were being inept. They weren't doing their job.
And he was relatively inexperienced.
I don't know. Terry signed the warrant and the subpoenas on my searching my house.
Really?
Yeah. Terry.
So what were they searching for? Oh, okay. We got to back up now.
Okay.
Why were they searching your house?
They came, the intimidation. So they came to the house and they intimidated me several times and took things. They got subpoenas for Google. They got that, you know, hey, you could read whatever, whatever on my internet. I don't put anything.
This is important because we need to know this. I mean, potentially you're saying any citizen could be targeted.
Yes. We're seeing it right now. I mean, nationally. And I know I wasn't the only one in this case that was targeted.
And so what were they ostensibly claiming in order to get a subpoena? I know I'm getting really detail oriented, but you know, it's kind of scary. And I think that people want to know.
Trust me.
Okay. Why? Or, you know, what can they say to just go through all of our stuff and our emails? I mean, that's some private matters.
They were saying that I was obstructing an ongoing investigation, but they didn't even need that. They could have gone in saying, you know, they don't like me. And they would have, in Tennessee, you're going to have a judge sign off on that. And in Tennessee, you're going to have people happy to go and intimidate a citizen.
Now, is this a Tennessee problem? Is it more of a problem there, or is this systemic throughout the country?
Is it a Tennessee problem? I'm more of aware, obviously, I'm aware of it here because it personally happened to me. And they wanted to shut me down, and the DA said he was going to arrest me for obstruction of justice, and they went to, as I understand it, for the reporter, he's the only reporter, by the way, that stood by me.
And to give him, you know, props, Dennis Ferrier of Nashville 17 now, I think?
Fox 17 now. Yeah, so this is interesting to me. So, you know, what they did, Eric, was they intimidated me. They told me, you know, not to speed. And I mean, who does that? And they interviewed as many people as they could, trying to build a case against me.
On obstruction?
On anything. In anything. They wanted to get me for something. So they got my Google, and probably, you know, I get prayers sent in every day. I get, you know, people asking me to do reality shows every day. So they got to read all that kind of stuff.
But you can also get private information from relatives that they should know nothing about. Or case information that potentially could be against them.
Exactly. They got it, though.
Hmm.
They got it more than once. They got it for a while.
Hopefully you have taken steps to help mitigate that in the future.
Well, interesting you should bring that up, because working the Lauren Agee case, I was brushing my teeth one morning and I had my computer up. I had been working on it. And all of a sudden, my mouse starts moving around. I had toothpaste in my mouth brushing, and I yelled to my husband, go get my phone. And the files that were being opened were the Lauren Agee case. Now, at this point, I have pretty good security. So there are only two groups that could break in like that. So if you're targeted, are you forever targeted?
Probably. I've had, I don't know if you know her, but Emmy-winning journalist and anchor Cheryl Atkinson.
I know who she is.
She also was hacked by somebody in the Obama administration. We don't know, you know, which department, but yeah, she had that, and she's in an ongoing case at this point.
Right.
Similar thing. So yeah, it does happen. And out of curiosity, with, like, for example, your email, you work for some attorneys.
Yes.
Is it possible to have an account tied through them so you can't just break into the account because of a work product that potentially?
So I think you and I may have a difference of opinion here. You're thinking that someone who's breaking into a computer is going to be respectful to an attorney's email address.
Well, no. I'm thinking that you can prosecute them later. I know, you know, potentially that, yes, anybody can do anything they want. You're in the business. You capture information that people don't want to share.
Right, but I do it legally.
Okay, but you could do it illegally. You know the tricks. You know how. It's possible.
If I went down that road, I'm sure I could.
So somebody else could do it to you.
They do it.
So that's what all I'm saying is that, yeah. You understand that, but all you can do is try to mitigate things as much as possible. You're right. They may or may not respect it, but then if you catch them, at least then you have very actionable.
Right. My new thing is Proton Mail.
I was going to say Proton Mail and encryption.
So, I mean, the things I don't care about can come through my regular account, but anything that's important goes through Proton or Hush, you know, any of those.
And the iPhone, they're doing a good job with that.
I don't trust the phones no matter what.
Well, I'm just saying in terms of keeping the data there. Now, if you use iCloud, they can get it off of the server.
Sure.
But using Proton Mail on the iPhone, you're in pretty good shape.
Right. And, you know, I make decisions on how I do things because of that. Because I know, first of all, I know the bad guys can get it. And I know that you don't know who the, I think I know who the bad guys are. It's not who I expected. But, you know, I try to keep things, I still like paper.
Well, let's go into that because, you know, have you ever heard of Hanlon's Razor?
No.
Okay, Hanlon's Razor, and I'll probably butcher it a little bit, but it is essentially never ascribe to malice that which can be explained by stupidity.
Right.
Is that possibly the case for a lot of these things? And I want to go into the Lauren Agee case.
Okay.
From everything I've seen, the investigator was woefully unqualified to even be on that case.
Correct.
It sounds like he just didn't do anything except write a paragraph.
He admitted that in a deposition, he didn't do anything. Neither did the sheriff.
One thing after another. He just said, did you do this? No. Why not? I just didn't. Did you do this? Why not? I just didn't. I've never actually heard anybody say, I just didn't. I've never heard that as a follow-up. No, that was unique. I mean, it's like, but he was being truthful. I guess it's just, it's mind-boggling.
He was now, being truthful.
Is this a case, though, and I'm going to draw a weird parallel because my mind is twisted, of like Lance Armstrong. Now, in this case, you have an incompetent investigator. He drops a ball, makes a few mistakes. We're trying to cover him, make sure he's okay. We have Lance Armstrong. He's cheating. Everybody else is cheating. People start to look at him. He attacks the people who are looking at him. People are starting to look at the investigator. That looks poorly upon the sheriff. The sheriff is an elected position. And I am going to guess that Hannah has a family of influence because her part of the case seems to have been pushed back on the hardest. Now, is this what's going on here? Is just a cascade of errors and people keeping on doubling down to cover themselves? What are your thoughts?
I see what you're saying, and I'm thinking through about the Lance Armstrong thing. I never thought about that.
I'm sure you didn't.
It's great. It's great.
That's what crime is, isn't it? I mean, or a lot of things, especially like fraud. A lot of fraud starts with borrowing paper clips for the house.
That's so funny. You're right. So I think the difference between the analogy is Lance Armstrong is an intelligent person.
Okay. That's true. Yes.
He is.
So and you're he's giving, also a super athlete.
Yes. He, regardless. I mean, strategically, he's one step ahead of these people strategically. And he circled himself with really smart people that could help him pull it off. That's not the case in DeKalb County, Smithfield, Tennessee. That case is you've got a strong mom who is questioning the male authorities. And I'm not a sexist, but I know what I'm dealing with. And Eric, I'll tell you, nobody has this. So I'll tell you, after being in the court the first time with the mom and dad, the stepdad, who are fantastic people, they want one thing done. What happened to their daughter? It's not like they're asking for any, they're not asking for the Mueller report, or they're not asking for something else, you know, crazy. They're asking what happened to their baby. So we're sitting in court and the judge does what the judge does. Now, my son was at Vanderbilt Law School at the time last year. So I called him when I left the courtroom and I said, okay, I wrote down these things. This is this, this, and this. And I was able to talk over with my son what he's being taught at Vanderbilt, which I suspect they do a good job. They probably do know the law there. And
I hope
I do too, because he's got a good job. I mean, he's a good attorney now. But what was interesting is my son was able to say, no, here's the reason you can't do that. And I said, well, the judge just did that. And he goes, well, you can't do that. You can't do that. You can't do that. And while we were in court, the judge, now understand, I'm not loved. The judge berated me there too.
Yeah, I will listen to that.
Oh, no, you didn't. You listened to the third time.
Oh, okay,
what
you published. Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is the first time. And I looked at Sherry and I said, I don't think I should come to these cases because he obviously doesn't care for me. And then he said something about Sherry, the mom. And I was like, okay, now we got a problem.
Wow.
So he didn't say anything about the stepdad or the dad. So strong females in the South that are aggressively questioning males is the problem.
It can be. I live in Virginia. It's not that completely different from Tennessee. Now, fortunately here, there are very strong females with the military around, and I think it's mitigated. But I can see that because I'm also from Arizona, and I think women are bit more equal there too.
I would say Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama,
Northern Florida.
Exactly.
Which is also known as Southern Alabama.
Yes, exactly. So those areas, they really don't want to see a female saying, you might be making a mistake.
I think there are some people who are still that way.
Oh, they are that way here.
The bless your hearts. But there are others who are not. I'm going to, you know, say that. I hate to say it. A friend of mine said that science moves a graveyard at a time. I think it's similar here. A lot of this is very old-fashioned, traditional, and it's slowly dying off.
Well, the judges that I'm dealing with, or the DAs are around my age.
Which is sad.
Yeah. And also, so I have another case where I have a female judge who's so fantastic. I can't say, you know, she follows the law so well. And I'm always sitting in her courtroom going, why can't we have somebody like that? I had Daily Mail 2020 and Dateline in a courtroom with me with that judge, because I told them, we're all three women, and myself, and the judge is female. And right before we went in, we were all at hotels chatting and stuff. And I said, y'all, they all know me from my cases. They all, you know, I'll call them and say, I have a case you may want to look at. And so they'll come to the court cases and stuff. Well, so the night before, the cutest, she's Daily Mail, Laura Collins, she's adorable. She says, I'm nervous for you because you are giving this judge a lot of credibility and basically kudos. And I said, just wait, let's see. I said, I may be let down tomorrow, but let's see if she follows the law. We go through court and we're about to wrap it up, and Laura taps me on the shoulder and she goes, you were right. But Laura's been through my other cases with me, that these male judges, and I'm married to a man. I have boys, you know, I'm not beating men up. I love men, believe me. But we have a problem in Tennessee, I believe.
I actually think that that may be a tendency. And I don't know if you've read some of the studies, but a good example is, how do you get more women in the workplace, you know, especially in STEM and places like that? One of the problems they've come across is that on applications, females have a tendency that if you put a list of five items that you need to have this, and this, women will not apply unless they have a high percentage of those items, like all four or five, you know, like 80% to 100%. And men, on the other hand, men are like, well, I read about that once. And they're fine applying if they're about halfway there, saying, I'll figure it out as I go. No,
interesting.
It's a very studied research thing. So it has come out that if you really want to apply or have more women, you need to be vaguer in the qualifications to where they feel comfortable enough to come in. Don't be too specific, or they may feel that they're not qualified.
Well, what's interesting,
judges could work that way too. Like,
I think you're right.
You know, crossing all the T's. Oh no, the law says A, B, C, and D, and I have to follow 80 to 90%. Okay, I can interpret slightly. Or as a men are like, well, the law means this. This is the spirit of the law.
That's actually probably accurate. But in Lauren's case, sitting there, now we know, you know, the judge got a smackdown, a Southern smackdown.
Oh no, it was beautiful. That's not Southern. That's a universal, because it was legal speak saying this rube who put this ruling down is so incompetent. It was one of the hardest smackdowns I've ever seen it, but it's put in legalese, but essentially he was called a moron, incompetent, and a dreamer.
Well, and what's funny about that is, of course, I sent it on to Dateline in 2020, all the people following the case, because 2020 was in the courtroom. You know, the audio that I have is because 2020 and Dennis Farrier were in the courtroom, and because he doesn't allow people to record. So you have usually the first two times you had to put your phones and any recording device away. He doesn't allow it. So this
I bet you he's going to enforce that now for sure.
We only needed this one. Yeah. And, you know, he's up for election. Now, it's up to the voters in his area whether or not this is the kind of person you want. But I'm going to point one thing out that we haven't talked about. In that area, I question how many women are killed and murdered and nothing happens. And there is a documentary being investigated about that area right now. I'm not part of it. I just know of it. One of the major networks has a production company looking at that area.
Pretty rural, isn't it?
It's rural, but there are too many females in that water that die.
Oh my God.
That nobody does anything. And so it's very interesting. So you've got, and you have to look at it. You've got the sheriff, who we know now for real what he's like, and his detectives. And then we've got the DA, who was a real estate agent, or not agent, real estate attorney. Now's the DA.
Okay. Well, this sounds to me, I mean, I've got to ask the three-letter question, FBI. Why are they not there?
So, you know, I don't know. I think the FBI in Tennessee have a lot of other issues right now.
Because this does seem like the point that, you know, I don't appreciate government involvement in civic affairs necessarily, but there is a point that sometimes a higher law enforcement that has more stringent controls may have to come down and say, oh, what's your procedure? How does this work? How are you doing things? I'd say the TBI, but there's problems there too.
Well, to that point, now let me tell you, TBI looked at the case, said nothing to see, move along.
Well, I would have said that's weird, but then I know about the Holly Bobo case.
So well, and that's not the only case. So one of the things that was a report recently was TBI was hiring. Two things happened on that. Number one, they hired someone's son who was a pizza delivery boy over an agent coming from California.
Oh, we don't need anybody from California.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Yep.
And besides, we know the boy.
That's right. He's a good old boy.
You know, he's with the family. And you know, I could go both ways on it. It's not always insidious. It can be insidious. Sometimes the most qualified person is related and you've known them their whole life. Like your son, he's a lawyer. You probably work with other lawyers. And if he needed work, a reference, it could be fine. But it can be insidious. It depends. There's always nuance.
Yeah, but my son's educated in law. He's not a pizza delivery boy going.
Oh, I
understand. We paid $300,000 for that education. He needs to, you know, he knows what he's doing. He's not delivering pizzas.
Right. And like I said, that can be gross and insidious. But I did want to say that not all nepotism is bad.
Okay.
Now, if somebody truly is qualified.
It truly qualified, but who's making the decision? That's the first story. The second story is when they were picking the new Mark Gwynn had to step down. And
okay, he did.
Yeah, right. He did. Actually, everybody who attacked me no longer works at TBI. You know, I'm sure there's one or two that were involved that I don't know about that may be still there.
And let me guess, you can't sue them, can you?
You know, and I'm not going to.
Okay.
The best thing to me is to move on and expose it. Why would I spend money going after them?
But that's true.
Yeah. No, I the best thing ever is to expose who they are. And, you know, I don't believe in revenge. Now, I'll stand up for myself, I promise. But I don't believe in revenge, including with my clients. But, you know,
or maybe make yourself so toxic they don't want to mess with you because they might get burned.
I'm going to say that I'm going to be the person telling the truth. Mm-hmm. And if I had a case and Mark Gwynn came up against me, mm-hmm. I know I win. Because I'm going to be looking at the places that. He would
what
go.
What I'm troubled by, though, is I hate the whole combative or win-lose scenario, because really, you're talking about a victim here and families, and there's no winning and losing. There is a crime, and hopefully somebody will answer for it, or a solution or answer will be provided. And that combative thing, I think, is so dangerous. I don't like it in the court system. It troubles me personally.
I couldn't agree with you more, but the education I got on the Holly Bobo is it was a win-lose. They won against me on that until the trial, and they had to say, we lied, we were wrong. And then funny, Channel 4, who fired Dennis Farrier over this, calls me to see if I'll do an interview because they retracted what they retracted about everything we did. They retracted all of it saying I'm a liar, right? They call me saying, will you come on? And I said, retract a retraction of a retraction? And I said, no, you had a story of a lifetime. And you all chose to go with what TBI was feeding you to say horrible things about your coworker. And he stood by me. I'll follow him anywhere. So I went on his show.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. You seem to have a definite relationship with him. And by the way, he had a obvious glee when he was talking about the judge being overturned. he wasn't hiding any of that. That was fun to watch. I was like, okay, he had Christmas early.
I know. And there are a couple cases that it's so sad because we try so hard and you get beaten up all the time. And I do call it a win because when I talk to the moms, I'll say there are two things. Cause I talk to my moms, all these moms. I don't have just one mom. I have several moms. I'll say we had a good day today. We won a little bit. So I do use the win lose because.
But that's win for justice. Not like, when like, oh, I beat you in court, he got off, or he got prosecuted.
I see what you're saying.
Or we got somebody busted, because that to me is the really dirty tunnel vision that prevents people being open to say,
we screwed up.
Or we're not right here. You know, rather than saying, okay, we're just not right, we need to look into this and try to mitigate the damage, not double down.
Well, what's interesting about what happened, and I got a great lesson early on with the Bobo case. What was really interesting is how they played it. So they had me doubting what I thought I knew and had information and evidence and, you know, interviews.
Oh, that's right. They played it off that you were incompetent. Yes. And you... what was it?
Lied.
You made genuine errors that have now sent the investigation down the wrong path and wasted man hours and potentially mucked up the case.
Right. And there's a documentary being done that all of the FOIAs on that, they're going to have to back up. Won't that be great to see that?
Well, speaking of documentaries, I mean, you're a walking television show, aren't you?
I get asked all the time.
I mean, has anyone approached you?
I get asked.
It could be a series.
I know. I get asked about 3 times a week, and the answer is no.
Okay. Why?
Because this is truly what I believe. There's only one of me doing this in the country right now. Me, working with the victims, doing from start to finish everything. I'd like to mentor. I have four women that I'm mentoring right now to hopefully reproduce what I'm doing.
And the two Michaels help you, right?
Oh, I have other guys, but they're not going to step into what I do. They have their own niches.
Right.
And then I am the only person that works really for the victims to find out answers. If I do a show, these families have nobody.
What about, out of curiosity, and the reason why this came up is I've watched the show Cold Justice off and on for years.
Kelly.
And yes, it was very similar to me, to what you're doing. And I thought, oh, you should work with Kelly. I was like, oh, wait, no. She always works with the authorities when they call her in. They're probably not going to call you in.
No.
But a variant of that, what you do, potentially, you know, if not a dramatic series, which I was thinking obviously would be a very interesting series, or even a serial comedy, but just a straight documentary series where you get these cases that could help fund it. I mean, the money is so expensive.
It is.
That you can get that TV money behind it and potentially get $100,000 an episode or whatever, and can go a long way.
Right. You know, right now, the right thing hasn't come along. Let's just put it that way. And, okay. You know, the reason I do like People Magazine and 2020 and Dateline, and I've got a great producer at Dateline, and Crime, what is it called? Daily Mail. She's fantastic. You know, the reason I do that is because I know that's immediately going to get out there. And like on Dateline, they're fact checking, and Daily Mail, they're fact checking. They're going to make sure I'm telling them exactly right. So I like that kind of publicity out there.
Plus, they may find out even more that you missed and they can share it with you because they have a team.
Well, and one of the things I don't work with, I always try to work with the police. I'll tell you that. That's always my first option. The door shuts very loudly behind me, however. And I know it going in. But reporters always work with me.
Right.
I may not work going in like Kelly does. And, you know, I know Kelly, we're doing Crime Con. She's doing Crime Con. I'm doing my workshop at Crime Con. I know all these crime people. So... some I have a great deal of respect for, and the reporters are the ones that get things that not even the police may know, because a family may tell the reporter something. So I may have something that they don't have yet.
Well, yeah, and that makes sense too, because I'm sorry to say we're all a little bit of fame whores.
Yes.
So sometimes the reporter will get, because, ooh, I'm on TV. Mm-hmm. And I'm also guessing that when you hit the case, you may get things too, because A, you don't have a time limit in 5 cases that you got to get to that day. And sometimes maybe a little time's gone by and maybe that person who was in love a year ago, they broke up now and they had a horrible falling out, and I'll get that son of a bitch.
And I go in nice, very nice. And usually there are mommy issues.
And you like to say you're the dumbest person in the room.
I am.
Which I see you, and I'm LinkedIn connected with another female PI, Kelly Martin, who looks like a model, and she does a lot of skip tracing and capturing people, bail jumpers. I'm like, oh God. I look at the both of you, I'm like, you're so dangerous. You're so freaking dangerous.
No, you're not supposed to see that.
Oh, that's the first thing I see is like, I mean, everybody is going to assume somebody like me, 6'2", whatever. I just look like I can be a cop or whatever. I look like I don't belong. You can look like you don't belong and people will come to help you.
Yep. Every time.
And she's on that, you know, model side where
she's attractive. Just imagine.
Oh yeah. 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 So she goes into the bar and it's probably so easy. Oh, you're going to buy me a drink? Here's a handcuff.
Right. I mean, you just have to go in. One of my mentors, now the two mics, I only work with one of the mics. The other mic I worked on he worked the Lauren Agee case. We don't work in general. I have a team. Mike Kenny he works celebrity stalking cases. So we'll work together on a few things. And he won't tell me the celebrities, so I have nothing to gossip about. No, I wouldn't tell anyway, but...
So you can't stalk him? Yeah. No, I'm just kidding.
I love it.
You just say, is it a how-to? No.
He's so good at what he does, and it's so amazing. He will call me sometimes and say, I'm going into this area, I'm turning my locator on. I'm the only one that knows where he is. He'll be in LA or New York or wherever. He travels all over.
Scary.
It is scary, you know, and he's got 4 kids. So it does that kind of stuff. But I have a team of people. There's a podcast coming out that Resonate Recordings and Black Mountain Media and Tenderfoot, which is up in Vanished, is doing. And the podcast is coming out in June. And they hired me to be the PI, and I took my team. And we went to a compound and did our interviews. And one of my new PIs that I'm mentoring, we were in the mornings, we would have our meeting. And she goes, I have never been to a meeting where guns were handed out, checked out. And I was like, oh, they don't do that in staff meetings. She works for a Christian right now. They don't do that in staff meetings when you're going out. So.
That's actually fantastic, though. I have a military background, and I have an appreciation for the armory and a weapons master who makes sure that, A, that they're all functional, they're all correct, all working, and that they're handing the proper equipment out.
Mm-hmm. So we have one of the guys that we were flying into another state, and all, you know, it just the logistics. I had PIs from Indiana. I had PIs from Florida. I had, PIs actually from all over come in. And but we had one that handled the guns, and he was former. He did the game Miami cop, and he handled just making sure everybody had the right stuff.
You know, that brings me to a question that I had, and it was actually for my wife, but she likes to ask applicants, describe what to you is an ideal work day. Well, I rephrased it. Because of all the craziness in your life, I almost want to close with this question. Describe a typical, and if not typical, a recent work day.
Okay, I'm going to take you through a typical or just recent. I'll give you a recent.
Because I'm assuming you don't have typical work days.
No, I don't. Generally, I'm gone from home. I'm usually out of town for weeks at a time. So I flew from Florida to Mississippi, got there around at 9 at night, and had to drive 2 hours to the compound. And at the compound, two of the other investigators had already gotten there and checked everything out, and you had chains and I mean, it's not an easy case. Okay. And we all stayed together. So there were 12 people in one house, all investigators working. And by the time we got there and settled, it was around midnight. And then at 2 a.m., some of the other investigators arrived. And then we sat down to prepare for our next day of interviews. 23 interviews had to be done. We had assignments for each person to go find these people. We had backgrounds and profiles, and paperwork was handed out, and who was carrying what gun, who couldn't carry a gun because they were going into a jail, what to expect. But let me tell you never get what you expect.
Sure.
And then as we were going through the day, we had to go to the crime scene where it happened. And so I generally, since I'm the lead, I go to as much stuff as I can, plus doing interviews, meeting with a potential DA, because I will say this, the judges, the DAs, and the sheriffs that I work cases around and see that they're not defending the victims, I do try to help the next time that they run to see what we could do about getting them replaced. Very quietly, but it happens. Probably not so quietly now, Eric.
Especially now.
Yeah.
You have that in common with Kelly, by the way.
What? The
going after a DA.
I don't know if it's going after. It's just getting the right person in there.
Okay. You word it different ways.
Yeah, I'm not after anybody.
I had a lieutenant when I was in the Army, and we talked about kicking soldiers out. And he said, I like to think I'm helping them find something that suits them.
That's what I'm doing. That is what I'm doing. So I met with a potential DA to basically interview to see if I would endorse and get the women victims' families to back them. So what I do is if you start as one of my clients, you usually come in broken by the time you finish and we get answers, and it may not go to court, you may not get a conviction, but boy, you are a ferocious lion by the time I'm done with you. And we have answers, and they've gone through this horrific process. So those moms have to work with me making changes. That's the deal I have with them. And every one of them is just outstanding. So if we pick a DA or a sheriff, they're working the campaigns to make sure that they get these people out. So met with the DA, counsel people. Then I interviewed another investigator who worked the case. And I think it was 9 o'clock at night. I went over to the family's house and talked to her. And then 11 o'clock, we have a staff meeting. So at 11 o'clock, everybody had to be back at the house, sitting in the dining room with their stuff all together for the next day. And that's that, you know, and then we sleep for 2 to 4 hours, but that's a work day. And then we get up and do it again.
Wow. And I said that I was going to wrap it up and be the last question. I lied.
Okay.
And this is directly related. What kind of emotional toll is this taking on you and your family? And I ask this specifically because you changed up in the middle of your life, and it could be argued that your family could say, hey, we didn't sign up for this. We signed up for another person.
Great question. It is discussed a lot around here. So my children are grown. Okay. Obviously, one's an attorney in D.C., not criminal. He does not want to do that or anything like that. He's a patent attorney.
Money.
God, we hope so. There's a big bill behind that. So he had to pay for college himself. We didn't do it. So the other one, he is in Seattle in that gaming industry that I still don't understand. And huge industry, lots of money in that as well. But my son, who's an attorney, is not an advocate. He works very, very hard. My son, and works hard for his clients, but he does not step out in the advocate role. My son in Seattle is an advocate, a victim's advocate. So, he takes after me. And I see his role, you know, progressing in that way. So my son in Seattle supports any and everything I do. My son in DC does not. He worries all the time because he knows the law and he knows what can happen. My husband, who is... I can't even begin to tell. We've been married 31 years. So we've grown up together. I mean, we've gone through a lot. And the emotional roller coaster that he's seen, he has paid when TBI did their thing. We paid two very high priced attorneys to keep me out of jail because they kept saying they were, if they could have, they would have thrown me in jail. But because we had two high priced attorneys, it was going to be a little difficult. Then he's asked me to quit more than once. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, I wanted to ask that because while it's, you know, seen from the outside as maybe being glamorous.
Not.
I can just see it as being a huge toll. And you probably get as many or more losses than wins if we're getting down that path. And that has to weigh on you.
And that's why I have three dogs. That's an accurate story. I'll tell you, Jeremy Taylor, his deposition, I drove away from there so devastated that I called my husband. I said, I want a puppy. He said, no. And I went and got a puppy.
Oh, well, he should know better.
He does. He does. He does. And I got a wild one, which is good because he keeps me busy.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find you and find out more?
So you can go to SheilaWysocki.com. The podcast is getting its own website, Without Warning Podcast.
Very cool.
I have three new expose podcasts coming out.
Really?
Mm-hmm. pretty shocking exposés. So
maybe we can talk about.
Yeah, we'll when they hit, I think you'll probably want to talk. You'll be shocked.
Okay. Well, hey, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. And if you like what you heard, please consider subscribing for free. And I mean for free. It is always free. There's no billing, anything else. You can subscribe in your player of choice, which is probably right in your hands. Or you can go to unstructuredpod.com. And there are plenty of links there. Thank you so much. And in the spirit of sharing, here's a couple more shows you may want to check out.
Mr. Hayes' office, how may I help you?
Andrea, it's Marilyn over at Kennedy Parker Construction.
Hello, Marilyn. Would you like me to connect Mr. Parker to
Mr. Hayes? A fish surrounded by sharks. A secretary cursed by desire and ambition. Introducing The Diarist by Donna Barrow Green. The Diarist, an addictive psychological thriller, satirical, suspenseful, and full of twists. Available on iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts.
Yes.
I'm sorry if I've hurt your feelings. Or if something I've said has led you to believe I think you're incompetent.
It's just been so long since you've given me any encouragements or compliments on my...
Andrea. I do notice you. I like that blouse on you very much. You look very pretty, just as you are right now.
Oh. Well, I...
It's very pretty on you.
Thank you.
What sort of fabric is it?
It's silk.
It's lovely. You have excellent taste in clothes. I notice. Would you mind removing your cardigan?
My sweater?
Yes, so I can see the blouse in its entirety.
Why?
I like it very much. You see, I do notice you. You know that, don't you? I don't have to tell you I notice these things. You know when I like something, don't you?
I don't know.
I repeated his words in my mind. I notice you. That was it, wasn't it? I wanted someone to notice me. Not Andrea the daughter, the wife, the secretary. Not even Andrea the artist or ad girl. I wanted someone, anyone, to see me. More than anything, it was Richard. Please don't think unkind of me, dear reader.
Hi, this is Kara Mayer Robinson, and I host Really Famous. I interview A-list celebrities. I dive deep because I used to be a therapist. This is what Tim Gunn said.
I just have this antipathy for the judges. I can't stand being in the same room with them.
Tim Daly.
If you're not working in L.A. and you're an actor, there's no worse place to be.
Michael Rapaport.
I changed schools every year from the third grade to the 12th grade. Disruptive was my thing.
Chaz Palminteri.
I knew something was going on. I said, I got to talk to somebody.
It's Really Famous. It's like eavesdropping on a therapy session.
Hi, my name is Matt Kirshner from Right Track Media, the podcast production service. If you guys like the editing you heard today, please feel free to reach out at matt@righttrackmedia.com. Track is spelled T-R-A-C. Again, that's matt@righttrackmedia.com.